Welcome, friends, once again to another episode of Categorically Insane, the podcast where one professional author and one professional snarker take a deep dive into our corner of the publishing industry that everybody makes fun of but can't stop reading. We're hanging out here digging through the annals of Harlequin romance. Amber, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I am great. You know, I have to say, our regular listeners will know that the early years of books have been real hit and miss for me. But there are a lot of things that I really liked about this one.
Hey, same. Okay, so I'm first again?
Yes.
All right. I have 1947's Close to My Heart by Margaret Nichols. The cover is a woman in a nice winter outfit. She has dark hair, red headband. It's in the mountains. There's a house in the background that is supposed to be a hotel, but it looks small for a hotel. And the heroine looks very happy. The hero is standing behind her. He also looks very happy, which is funny because he's not in the book, but he's wearing what looks oddly like the military uniform worn by the dad in The Sound of Music. He has a cane. The plot of this book was really confusing to me, just as a note at first, because it does not read as a romance. And I think you also read this book. So it doesn't have the right pacing. It doesn't focus on the things that are romance related, even though it's clearly meant to be a romance. If you read the description on the inside cover, the description on the cover makes it sound like there's going to be some kind of love triangle between the main character and the hero and his sister-in-law and the heroine, and that is just not what it is. It's not that kind of story. So I'm going to read the inside cover. There was every reason why Lydia shouldn't have married Chris Stark. She had known him only a few days before they eloped, and I guess I didn't catch that because I was real surprised when that happened. And the few things she learned about him held no promise for an easy future. Chris had returned from an overseas unheard outwardly except for a slight limp, but he had lost his confidence in himself, and he believed his handicap prevent him from again being a successful lawyer. Lydia was not only had to convince him that he was wrong about this, but she found she must adjust herself to his curious assortment of in-laws, which included sultry Kirby Stark and her son. Kirby had been married to Chris's brother, who was killed in action, and she had come to regard Chris as a substitute for her own husband, which is not true. There was another man who loved Lydia, and his life with him would have been simpler and pleasant. But Lydia couldn't leave Chris, even after their whirlwind honeymoon had dissolved into the difficulties she had foreseen. She had to find out if her love was stronger than Chris's resentment, or than Kirby's resentment and Chris's emotional turmoil. Yeah, that's not what happens. I mean, I guess it is in a way, but they make it sound like Kirby is like some kind of a, you know, third in a love triangle, and it is not like that.
That's interesting. I wonder sometimes with some of these, when the stories were bought, did they sort of torture the description a little bit to make it fit the budding romance genre?
Yeah. Either they bought it on spec and wrote the beginning before, or they tried to make it sound more like a romance than it was.
Yeah.
Because this entire story, like, really nothing happens. Like, it doesn't have a lot of action. It's just a story about what happens after people are hurt and killed or killed, like, in a war. And what happens to the people who are left behind, and what happens when they come back and try to start a normal life. I mean, it's not, there's no, you know, rise in action or anything. Nothing happens. The hero goes back to being a lawyer at the end.
Right.
So, I mean, that's like what it's building up to. This is really, it's like an entire book preaching about why war is bad, which makes sense considering the context of the time. Some of the characters just like really plainly state that war is evil, and some of them just seem vaguely horrified by the ravages of war. But it's not a plot. But I'll tell you anyway. The heroine's named Lydia Ash. The hero is Christopher Stark. She is 22. I am not clear on how old he is. She thinks he's much older than she is sometimes. And sometimes she thinks he's hardly older than her at all. It never does say how old he is. She's described as having dark hair, which is neither wavy nor straight, which I can relate to. She calls her mood willful isolation, which made me laugh. I was like, girl, same.
Yeah. I feel that.
He's described as being blonde and tan because tan is some kind of like requirement in every old romance I've ever read.
Of course.
You know, is not surprising given how many elderly people got skin cancer because of how tan everybody was. She says he's not only handsome, but arresting. And I have no clue what that means.
Oh, it means like they make you kind of stop.
Okay, so, all right. She lives in Baltimore, but is from somewhere west. That's just the word they use, west. Oh, which is so information this is in we only America. Have. Yeah, yes, it's in America. It's in Baltimore. Yep. I think this is our first American book.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things in here that are very different than, well, there's like one vaguely garbage neighbor, but there are no garbage women in this book.
Right.
She says she's a chemist, which in my mind, you know, I read a lot of Agatha Christie. So with my limited Agatha Christie knowledge, this means she's probably a pharmacist.
Yeah.
She's at a remote chalet in a location that is not disclosed. It's not Baltimore or West. We know that. We know it's fall because she says she's not cold enough for people to ski, but it's too cold for golf. Which she does anyway. She's golfing the whole time. And it's weird for me to picture that some, you know, young girl has gone to a resort by herself to golf.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's quite weird. She says she always sees the hero walking behind her, which apparently doesn't bother her, even though it's creepy.
Oh, man. You want to talk about certain tropes in early romance that have not aged well? Oh, boy.
It's also, he goes around the resort all the time wearing his uniform while he's on vacation. And I don't know if this is like a 40s thing, but most people I know, the military people I know, and I know a lot of military people would never wear their uniforms if they didn't have to.
Right.
So I think that's very odd. I don't know why he's wearing it. Maybe he's like doing R&R, but he's like still on orders. I really don't know. It's very strange. He's wearing it all the time.
I have no idea. I honestly, I have not read that one in a while. I just assumed it was a sort of author's shorthand for like he was in the war.
Yeah, and it might have been. So he was injured in World War II. Everyone knows it at the resort. I don't know how they know it. I guess just like gossip or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
She has an ex named Wade, or maybe she was just one-sidedly in love with him. I can't quite tell at this point, but I think it's her ex. The hero falls on the stairs and she hands him his cane and he loses his ever-loved mind and screams at her that he doesn't want anyone to help him. And he's like screaming at her. I was like, alrighty then, not a meet cute.
No.
She says later, this is like an actual quote from the book. Later, she was amazed that he had not struck her. And she has almost no reaction to this. If she's upset because he's basically threatened her, we don't see that. I just think that's so bizarre. He comes to her room later, like hours later, and tells her that he's, this is a quote, ashamed for his lack of deportment. But he does not apologize for being like 2 inches from hitting her.
Right.
But for his lack of deportment. He says he hopes she'll accept his apology. And she says, of course. And she seems to mean this. So, you know, I guess it works out for them. He asks her to go have a drink with him to show all the other guests who heard him losing his GD mind that she's forgiven him. She agrees to do this. I don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand that either.
Yeah, I don't know. Strange choice. He says she's a very beautiful girl without any like particular emotion. He just sounds bored about it, which is really weird. He thinks that she's too young to drink when he asks her to go have a drink with him, even though the legal drinking age is 18 at the time. So, ew. He literally thinks she's a child. She's really self-conscious about his injured leg to the point that it's like kind of weird. And again, my perception might be skewed because I'm surrounded by people with disabilities, but she seems like unusually fixated on this limp. And I don't know if she feels bad for him or if she's into it or like what. I don't know. She's just really thinking about it all the time. If like we've lived in that time period, it might be clearer why she feels that way. Like if it's a good or a bad thing. I really don't know. She just thinks about it like every second. Hours later, they go for a walk. This is the first day. And she is really into this dude, even though she's talked to him twice. And once is when he tried to hit her. But she's into him now.
It is that trope of, I can help him.
Yeah, right.
He is sad, but I can totally fix it.
I have things to say about that. And I was gonna save it for later, but I will say it now. I have my own mental health issues. There are lots of other people in my house with mental health issues. I do have a problem with people who are in the midst of a mental health crisis.
Right.
Starting a relationship.
Right.
That is not a good time. It's not a good time for him to be involving himself in something like this. And I feel like at the time period, that's just how it was. I feel like people just came back and pretended they didn't go to war and weren't having a mental health crisis.
Right.
I mean, both of my grandfathers, here's some information. Both of my grandfathers came back from war and became alcoholics. And both of them were in prison for quite some time for getting in bar fight. So, I mean, you know, clearly this was a thing that people just were like, well, this didn't happen or there's nothing we can do about it. So we're just going to pretend that it's fine and drink a lot. I don't know. I inherently have an issue with people who are in the middle of a mental health crisis starting a new relationship. Anyway.
Yeah.
The next day they go outside and they meet, and she says she doesn't like to stay in. She doesn't like to stay inside because outdoors makes her thinking bigger, which is some Alice in Wonderland nonsense. I do not know what she's talking about.
Yep. I don't know what that means either.
He tells her he's inherited a family with more indifference than I would give to inheriting a dog. His brother's Alan was a Marine who died 6 months before. He had an infant son he never met before dying. And so then Chris's sister-in-law is his responsibility. I'm not sure why. Her name is Kirby and her mother is named Theo, which are delightfully bizarre names for women at this time period.
Yes.
I'm really surprised. The heroine calls the hero a cripple, which is lovely. And he tells her, you're having lunch with me today. Doesn't ask her, he just says, you're having lunch with me today. And then he says he told the housekeeper to move her plate sitting to his table. I was like, wow, this one is a charmer right here. He says people think he's boorish, but I can't figure out why. It's still a mystery. He says he doesn't know anything about her. So she starts telling him a ton of bizarre stuff about herself. It has nothing to do with anything, including that she thinks old women would be pretty if they didn't wear so much jewelry.
Yeah.
This is a bizarrely strong stance about old people and jewelry, but that's her stance. And she loves the voices of colored people. Like that's the way it's written, singing, which made me say, oi. She's surprised he can pull out his chair while having only one hand that isn't using a cane. And why she thinks this is a two-handed job is not clear to me. Why would you think it takes two hands to pull out a chair?
Either? I don't know. I mean, perhaps. I mean, is the chair in like some sort of dimensional portal?
You know, one of my kids, he has only one arm that moves because he has cerebral palsy. And he is fully capable of doing many things, including, but not restricted to pulling out a freaking chair. I don't know why this woman thinks this is like a two-handed job, but she does. And then out of nowhere, and I mean literally nowhere, like the next paragraph, she is suddenly in love with him. The last chapter ends with him ordering her lunch, and now she's in love with him at the beginning of the next chapter. And I guess there's a time lapse. It doesn't say that, though. So to me, it reads like she had, like, you know, a head injury or something. She's, like, ordering dinner, and then she's in love with him. She's still really fixated on this cane and limp. So we learned that during this week that we did not get to see, she was falling in love with him. And one would assume this should be shown in a romance, since the primary reason of a romance novel at all is the romance. But we don't get to see that.
Right.
He tells her he's a lawyer and he has a house in Connecticut that he built himself. So he's clearly older than I thought he was. After this week we didn't see, she now refers to her feelings for him as the essence of her in a week.
Ooh.
That's a lot.
Yes, that's it. That's spiritually a lot. That's a lot. I don't know how I feel about that. But I feel like, again, that goes back to, you know, you've got this relatively independent woman. We got to sew her up quick, you know, like...
You know, I was thinking about the all women are garbage, sewing her up quick thing. I was thinking that they act like men are dogs or something, like literally they cannot, if there's a, you know, if they smell a woman who's not horrible anywhere nearby, they may change their mind about the heroine.
Right.
How insulting is that?
Well, I also think too, there was this going to some sort of psychology around the time, like when Sigmund Freud's work was still really widely regarded. There was this idea that when women fell in love, like they ceased to be rational or functional beings. And I definitely think we see that all over romance.
Which is utterly insulting.
Right. It totally is. I do think that we see that all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. We probably still do to less of a degree because we're still being insulted at on a regular basis by people.
Of course.
Because, you know, how can we possibly respect women? She's upset right. that he's not saying he loves her after this week they've spent hanging out at a resort, not being romantic, or at least, you know, not us seeing it anyway. So I believe this is definitely a 1940s sort of attitude where marriages were made quickly. Because if a man told me that he loved me after a week, I would freak the heck out.
If he told me that he mad about loved it. Me after a week, I would change my name and like apply for a new social security number.
For real. That is like stalker behavior. But she's upset because he hasn't told her after a week. We're now in chapter 3 and love has already been proclaimed by her in this very dramatic fashion. So at some point, it was so over the top, all of her thinking, that I was literally rubbing my hand over my forehead. So this guy, he has PTSD, which of course we were kind of alluding to earlier. So this guy, like I was saying, clearly has PTSD, which wasn't a thing at the time. If people were very bad, like we were saying before, they were called shell-shocked. He says he can't marry her because he's a cripple. I do not like this term.
Yeah, I find that really uncomfortable.
If he was the only one who uses it, I could excuse that as internalized hatred for his disability or whatever. But right. Everybody does. Everybody uses the word crippled. She says she doesn't care about it, even though she seems like 50% of the time this is like all she is thinking about. But she says she doesn't care about it. And then they start making out. So chapter 3 ends with them kissing. And chapter 4 starts with them leaving Georgia. I don't know when they went to Georgia, because in the grand tradition of this book, they are now married without any information at all.
Yeah.
So this book does not want us to see the important things in this relationship. This happened more than once. It's very bizarre. This is what makes me say it's not a romance. I mean, they're right. Skipping all the actual literal romance stuff.
Right.
And this book is extremely well written. It's a little bit hard to read because it's written like poetry. So like, here's an example. He's taking her to his house and he says, "But we're going home today. You're lovely sitting there, darling, with your black hair spilling over your shoulders and your eyes as black as your hair and the color coming and going to your face. Your beauty is of blood and bone and coloring, and we are friends as well as lovers. But the outside is bigger than this room, and this has come to mean so much to both of us. But outside, there is nothing that is going to hurt you, Lydia. I don't know why I say that, except you look so young and vulnerable, but unbreakable. There are resources in you of strength and fight that you haven't tapped. We've run the gamut, haven't we?" He has a lot to say there that is very weirdly poetic.
Yeah.
And I feel like I just refuse to believe that even in the 40s, people had casual conversations that sounded like, "Your beauty is of blood and bone and coloring." I mean, it's just very poetic. Again, without any kind of notice, they've left a hotel in Georgia and now they're in Connecticut. So we don't get to hear that either. She gets off the train and she says she had to be everything that he was used to and everything that he admired. That's, I was like, wow, thanks. I know, right? I said, thanks, I hate it.
Yeah.
She needs to be everything he admires and is used to.
Heaven forbid he get used to a different person.
Right. Or like that he understand that like people are not everything that you hope they would be. I don't know.
So. Yeah. I feel like in so many ways, right, this is an exploration also of obviously romance and writing and literary tropes, but it's also an exploration of the underpinnings of feminism. You know, like, you know, people talk about like things like, you know, maternity leave and harassment and discrimination in the workplace, but it's these underlying philosophies
that illustrate the real problem. Yeah.
Right. It's this idea, and it's the internalization of these issues that I think are really worth examining, and how this is literature that was sold to women. And
yeah,
that is the ideal that was sold to women as something that they should engage with.
Finn is constantly like, girls like blah, blah, blah. And I spend like half of my time trying to make him understand that girls are individuals. They don't all like one thing or another. But then we have media that is clearly saying, you know, women are all the same. And there's like some drive for everyone having to be the same. You have to be just what people expect. Meanwhile, I'm trying to convince my son that everyone is different and, you know, they're not. They don't all fall into a cookie cutter. But
right. And anyway. It's just this idea that like, you can't, like, that's not a partnership.
Yeah.
You know, like,
for sure.
That's not a partnership. Is I have to be everything that you expect me to do. Like, that's a job description, you know, and that's not.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't make sense. And it's just interesting thinking that, like, you know, 70 years ago, that was what women were sort of expected, you know, to.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. I don't know.
It is definitely like a job description.
Right.
We're now told it's been 3 weeks since that first kiss that I was talking about. So they've gotten married and been to 3 places in 3 weeks. So we go from no details to an entire chapter of details about his house and his neighbors and like his family and everything. I have no idea what I'm reading. She's like thinking about the decorations in his house. she's thinking about stuff outside. She says it's decorations in his house that she looks at, that she knew she liked his decorations, which is a very weird sentence. I think it's not a stretch to know when you like something. She could have just said that she likes his decorations, but she says she knew she liked them, which is very weird. If this guy's house is any indication, he's loaded. He has horses, tennis courts, a pool in his house in Connecticut. This guy is like prepped to be a senator or something.
Right.
So every time she looks at anything, she thinks about how he can't do it anymore now because he's quote unquote crippled. So apparently he can't swim or play tennis or ride a horse because his leg doesn't work very well, which is bizarre because I promise you can. This chapter just goes on in his sister-in-law and her mother. They lived at his house. They're the ones he inherited. They moved out when he got married or something, so she never met them. Apparently the brother's baby lives with a Swedish nurse instead of with the mother, and they only bring the baby sometimes. It's not clear to me where this baby and Swedish nurse live. I know that they don't live with the mother, Kirby. So the sister-in-law says she has trouble sleeping when the baby is around, so they don't live there, which is kind of how babies work. I don't know. By the time I got to chapter 5, I was just bored out of my brain because there's no real plot. It's just like a lot of emotional conversation.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea where the book is going at that point. Theo is Kirby's mother. So Kirby is the sister-in-law. Theo is her mom. Theo says that she's worried that Lydia hasn't married a man, but a case history, which is a very weird way of phrasing it. I don't exactly know what she means, but I think that what she means is that he's, you know, what she's married is someone who has a lot of issues and he's not a person anymore.
I interpret that as a little bit of like, she doesn't really love you. She only loves you because she feels sorry for you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. So Theo says that she thinks that Chris doesn't drink because he's worried he'll be an alcoholic. And Lydia denies that this is possible. But I don't know why she denies this is possible because it sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah.
Alcoholism is like a super big problem for people with PTSD. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholics for that exact reason. And it seems weird to me that she's denying that it's possible. It sounds like a really responsible thing for him to be doing to me.
Right. But is that about denying his trauma and refusing?
The not drinking? Or Lydia denying his trauma?
Is that like the whole idea of like, oh, it couldn't possibly because he's afraid of being an alcoholic because there's no reason for him to ever develop alcoholism because he's fine.
That's it. That's what I think that's what she's acting like. Right. She's denying that this is even a problem. For some reason, she thinks that Chris is trying to not be an alcoholic means that he might get worse. Like his PTSD might get worse if she acknowledges that. I don't know. It's very strange. This is an example of what I'm talking about in terms of this book being really well written. So this is him. This actually reminds me of Mike when he comes home from like long deployments. It's very weird when a husband comes home from a deployment. They're in this headspace that is not being there or being here. I don't know how to explain it, but it's weird. This is how they explain it. He says, not that at all. The house is essentially the same. I mean, this wasn't my home anymore when I can't and won't understand about the serviceman to act and be just the same as before he went away. They'll be shocked at his profanity. He didn't used to swear like that. He'll be like some foundling, but he wants to be the same. Doesn't he fit into the same pattern? This is what she says. He says, overseas, he doesn't think he's changed, but the quietness and dignity and privacy of a house, meals served on tablecloths with napkins and silver along with it, furniture that he must respect, the whole rhythm of normal everyday living will be so alien to him that he'll feel lost and bewildered. They'll wonder what's the matter with him. They'll say he doesn't act like his old self, but that he sits and stares into space and at night cries out in his sleep. They won't realize that for him, everything is in the past tense. And that with service life more ingrained in their nature will, for a while, wish that they were back on some base or some carrier, because the base or the carrier have become home and the men they fought with more like their brothers and their older brothers at home. Home will not suddenly be home again. He has an adjustment to make, same as he had when he became a soldier. I'm going to guess that this woman has some kind of relationship with a person who served in a war and has PTSD.
There has to be something.
Yeah, because that's a really profoundly accurate way of describing the way it is. It's like they're in this lost space between there and here for quite some time. So I think she must have had a husband or something, a brother, I don't know, but it's pretty accurate. So Kirby is on the other side talking about what it's like to be a war widow, and she says that they were wives and mothers and widows in the same year, which is very depressing. And then that's when I started thinking this book is literally not a romance, but a story about what it's like to come back from war or not come back. And I'm glad that you know, I was the one whose job it was to do this book, just because I can, you know, have some insight into it and can say that this is definitely accurate. And she has some kind of, I don't know, connection to this. I think her husband must have been in the war. The heroine's ex, Wade, shows up and he says he's jealous because she got married.
Interesting.
At page 103, the doctor treats Lydia for something. I don't remember what. And he says, get up when you feel like it. But of course, you'll make the most of your illness. You girls always do.
Oh, Jesus. Like, really?
I find men take a more dramatic turn to their illnesses than women do.
Well, right, because when men who actually can feel their pain are like, yeah, that's real pain, but like, it doesn't hurt me at all when my wife is sick, so she must be fine.
If I can't feel it, it doesn't exist.
Right. Right?
Oh my goodness. So she says that Chris is splendidly endowed.
I love that.
I don't know what she's talking about. I think she means that he's like fit or something, but that just makes me laugh a lot.
I don't know, but I wanna in my head canon, that is just a fabulous bit of raunch that got past a 1940s sensitivity reader.
Like, somehow they didn't notice. I think it's delightful. I love that. Splendidly endowed.
Yeah, like, all right, for so, all we know, it means like he had a lovely plot of land and a retirement plan.
Yes, exactly. We don't know what that means because it never says. But, you know, I know what it means to my sensibilities. So.
I wanted something filthy.
Me too, but we don't get that.
No, I know.
This is Kirby talking about her grief. And again, this is so well done. There is nothing to tell except that I'm trying to live in the present. Do you know how I feel? As if I'm just coming out of a dark hole where I've been crying. The sun hurts my eyes, but I'm trying to stand the light. I couldn't believe that life was just the same, that women still cared about clothes, and a sunny afternoon on Park Avenue is a beautiful sight. I thought the world had stopped and everyone had gone into a hole to cry as I had because Alan was dead. I'm alive, and this is my present, and I've got to learn how to live in it without Alan. I've got to make some plans, start feeling and living again. The last few months are blacked out. I felt nothing but grief and loss and hate. When I had Alan, I stopped hating. Knowing Andrew, who's her stepfather, taught me to hate. Knowing Alan taught me to love. And then she tells her, the heroine tells her to find somebody else. Because that's great advice. You mean to fall in love with someone else? I wonder. I feel dead inside now, consumed. I can't feel anything except old. I feel so old. It was just an accident that Alan and I got along so well, that we liked and wanted the same things. In the beginning, we just wanted each other. But when we found we didn't give a hang about success or a lot of money, or that we both wanted to live in a small town. It was funny when we laughed about it, but we found we both smoked the same brand of cigarettes, and we were both crazy about eating spaghetti in funny, smelly little places. The most wonderful part of it was not to be alone. Oh, so I think this is actually like a, yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is a very depressing book in that way, but it's also a really good book. It's just not a romance.
Right. It's and almost I think like calling, we are reading like the 1940s version of women's fiction.
Yeah, exactly. This is like Oprah Book Club crap. So this is very well written and it's very, very sad. This woman is an incredibly good author. It's not a romance. And I'm sure they just wanted to get it out. Like, they just wanted people to relate or to understand. I'm sure that she had a passion about this book. That's obvious. I read in the papers that he married a nurse. He likes to marry nobodies and make them to cool, perfect ladies with their hearts frozen over, thinking all the while that what a good guy he was for giving poor girls a break. There are various brands of cruelty, but Andrew's kind, this is her stepfather. Andrew's kind is suave and sugar-coated, and is the most humiliating I've ever had the hope to encounter. It's bad enough to humiliate an adult, but to humiliate a child, to cut deeply into her pride, is, next to killing her, the worst thing you can do to her. I thought that was really also a profound understanding of what it's like when parents purposely humiliate a child.
Right.
This woman seems to have a really strong understanding of a lot of mental things. Chris's boss has red hair. The book says it suggests he has a bad temper. I wrote, gee, I've never heard that one.
Right.
Because I have red hair and people talk about it constantly. Oh, you must be a
fiery temper.
Fiery. So let's see. 164, I wrote, oh, no, 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 no. So let's see. Let's see what we're getting here. Oh, geez. Okay. Here's a nice bit of casual racism for you. You are still beautiful. Yes, in spite of it. Has Theo told you what I said about you? No. When I was a schoolboy in my own country, he's Spanish, I think. I read about the Indians in yours. I read very much about Indian princesses. I tell Theo that you are my schoolboy's idea of Indian princess. It's spelled like princess, by the way. Your face, your hair, but not the pants. Oh, please, no, no, not pants. Oh, so it's casual racism and hatred of pants in one. And racism of a Spanish person.
That's casual awesome. Racism
of a Spanish person by using the word, by spelling it as princess. Here's her talking to this guy who's from Spain, talking about how he wants to be an American or whatever. She says, I don't think you'll be resented, Lydia said. We're not like that here. All the people who went before us came as foreigners. So he'll find us hospitable and insatiably curious. We're almost all mongrels, and most of us are rather proud of it, which I thought was a really ironic thing coming on the heels of the real anti-immigrant sentiment we've had.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't think you'd find that's true anymore. I thought this was also profoundly good. Perhaps it would seem trivial to some people. Perhaps if she stopped this man coming down the street and said, my husband was a trial attorney before the war, but he was wounded and now he has to use a cane. And then that's not all. He has lost his ability to concentrate. The things he knew and studied that ran through his mind as water now runs like water through his sieve. And now every minute he is in court is his first case. He went in on his cane with a mind not too sure of holding its own against a mind that has not known battle and pain and shock. Do you know what war is and what it does to a young man? Can't you understand why my whole heart is with him now? If he does it, others can do it too. Chris has assembled their crosses from the war. Some of the crosses you can see, as you can see Chris's limb, but others you cannot see. Illness is contracted and reoccurring from time to time, and wounds that their clothes hide. Or were you only interested in the victory parades? Flags flying and papers streaming from high windows and bands playing stirring martial music. Are you only interested in publicized heroes? Does all of this leave you cold because you know that the war is over and you've won it and that it's over and let's forget the whole thing? Today, while Chris, the handicapped veteran with an honorable discharge, tries to find his place in the presence, there a boy name is. He isn't simply Chris, my husband. The man, the boy, is over there. You believed in him and boasted about him. You said he'd win the war for you. Are you interested in him now? But for a few inches, he'd have given his life so that you could walk down the street a free man with free speech and open the door of every church and temple and synagogue. Is it trivial? Is it uninteresting what happens to those who come back? Would you dare say that it is unimportant? If the meaning behind Chris's appearance in the courtroom today isn't important, then the winning of the war wasn't important either. If they're coming back to find themselves a place that's unimportant to you or to me or to every one of us, then we are not worthy of what they have sacrificed for us.
Damn.
I know, right? Exactly. I was like, wow, this is a profound book.
Man, this is really before the 50s era McCarthyism really took hold in culture, huh?
Yeah, exactly. This is really, really a book about like truly connecting with the feelings that people had after the war.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. It is not a romance, but it's a good book. And I feel like I could relate to it a lot just because, you know, I have a husband who has PTSD from serving in a war.
Yeah.
Obviously his feelings, I mean, he wasn't constructed. He joined on purpose. So obviously he has, you know, patriotic feelings, but a lot of this now he can get therapy and medication and things that people were not provided at the time, but I can relate. And this is a profoundly accurate book, but it's very sad.
Yeah, it is. And I think that it's definitely a sentiment that still rings true today in people who see their loved ones coming home from fighting, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that we do, it's interesting because we do support people during a war, but then we pretend like it never happened as soon as it's over.
Well, we support people during the war so long as they're continuing to fight. But as soon as people, yeah, you know, need things like jobs and, you know, not predatory student loans and healthcare and whatever, then all of a sudden those things become really tough.
Yeah, exactly. We forget that they've, you know, performed a service for us, as we were saying, you know, when they were at war.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my book.
So that's how it ends?
Yeah. He does well in his court case and that's it.
Yeah.
So really, it's just literally an exploration of what happens during war.
That's kind of awesome. I mean, it's hard for, like, when we read, like, expecting certain things for this podcast, but I do love the fact that was a book.
Yeah. It was extremely well written, and it's a very good book. It just is not a romance. So it's weird to me that it fell into, you know, I research this stuff a lot, and it definitely is listed under the pantheon, but yeah.
We talked about this list for a very long time.
Yes, it took me weeks and weeks to make it. I think when we started talking about this project, it took me a good, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 months just to make the list. That was like the longest part of the prep. So what you got?
Okay, so I have Strange Recompense by, as I said before, Kathleen Ayerle. And I was pleasantly surprised by this book. It is absolutely a romance.
Good.
And it has many, many tropes of this early era. All women are garbage. You know, if people aren't married, that's why they're upset. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, all of that. But there are so many things in there that I would say, as a genre, we didn't really start seeing again until very recently.
Interesting. Like, some of these books are oddly prescient.
Yes. And there are some things in it that I really like the way that this author played with some of these tropes. So this is it's a amnesia story. If we ever make a drinking game, I think we definitely have to have heroin or hero illness.
Especially in the 80s or 90s, women were just popping up with amnesia all over the damn place.
Oh, yeah. So it's an amnesia story, right? This woman is found on like a cliffside road in Wales.
Oh, nice.
Because we're back in the UK. And she is brought by a woman named Ruth to like the village hospital. I actually want to go back. I want to read this because it doesn't go where you think it's going to go based on what it says. So it says, she didn't even know her own name. Panic gripped her at the realization that she had lost her memory. Why was she on this lonely clifftop anyway? Rescued at last, she found herself in the care of a doctor, a handsome man who fought to restore her awareness. And he made no secret of his increasing attraction to her. She, in turn, felt drawn to him. But until she learned who she was, dare she let herself fall in love. So I was not expecting the quality of the book that I got.
Can you tell me what's on the cover?
So the cover is the weirdest hand.
Okay, hold it up to the camera.
I will do that. So that it's bizarre.
What is going on with her hands, A? And B, that guy looks like Lurch.
Yes. He looks like Lurch, or I thought Tommy Lee Jones in Men in Black.
Okay, I think Tommy Lee Jones is oddly hot, so I'm not against
that. I mean, listen, you know what? I'm here for it, man. You know, she's got this like beautiful curtain of blonde hair, and either her fingernail is bent weirdly forward and she's holding her hands palm up, or she's got her fingers like very awkwardly laced together right under her face.
Her hands are doing something very odd, because I remember I was talking about how I have the Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Hands can do weird things because our connective tissue is not strong. So it's like she's doing some kind of weird EDS hand thing there.
Yeah, maybe she is. Maybe this is some good autoimmune representation.
I think it's probably just bad artistry.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of these paintings did not match these books. But
no, probably
in the
not.
Background, there is a car careening off of a cliff. with like a woman falling.
That's not dramatic or anything.
So like, way to give it away.
This is the beginning of every like romantic suspense in the 80s or 90s, I swear.
Oh, 100%, which is why it's a genre that I largely ignored. So she gets picked up by Ruth and taken back to sort of the village hospital. She's been walking for like a very long time and she doesn't really know why. Ruth picks her up and she can't remember anything, but she's like clearly been in a rough go of it. Two things that this book does really well at the outset. One is it actually establishes her, like in all of the books, right? There's always the rival woman and then there's the elderly woman who's either not a rival because she's married or not a rival because she's related to the hero or not a rival or because she's old. So,
yep.
We meet Ruth, who is young and is the sister of the hero. Her and she sort of deals with a lot of the like household things.
That's my middle name.
That's my mother's first name, actually.
Oh, is it?
She cool. She does a lot of that. And so they take her in and they call for Noel, who is the doctor across the way. And
his name is Noel.
Noel, yep, the first like Noel. So in the meantime, she sort of is there. She's kind of like passed out and they don't know what's going to happen. And this girl named Sarah, who is another nurse, thinks that she's going to die. And so they kind of go through and look at like what she's got in her possession and they see a ring. So they put it on her wedding ring finger because they're like, well, obviously, if you have this ring, clearly you are married. And you're going to die. So there we go. So Noel comes and they think that she's got like pneumonia. They're sort of like trying to figure out what's wrong with her. And they kind of think that maybe she's
going to die. Well, I mean, if she's walking around barefoot in the rain forever, she probably does have pneumonia.
Yeah, I mean, she got something because, I mean, she is clearly not having a good time. What comes to pass is that she is awake. And it's interesting is that we spend a fair amount of time in other people's POVs in this book. It is not just the heroine and a sentence or two here of someone else. We get key moments in the development of the story and the development of the relationship are seen through other people's points of view.
That is very strange.
They're not.
See that when you say head hopping and talk about Nora Roberts, that is the picture that I get. And that's why I struggled with Nora Roberts because she would have POVs of like literally one book I read. She had a POV of like two paragraphs of some dude driving a delivery truck who was like seeing something happen, but not something important to the plot. It's just weird. That's what I think of, you know, with head hopping is that you're getting POVs, like short POVs from people who are not the main characters.
No, we pretty much get, for us here, it is basically Ruth the sister, hero, heroine, Sarah the rival, are the four POVs that we largely get. And I thought that it was actually very interesting because in this book, we know that the hero is in love first.
Oh, interesting.
Right? How often does that happen?
Although in this case, not very often, but in this case, I would say that it's justifiable considering she doesn't know who she is, which has always been my problem with all the amnesia books from the 80s and 90s, is I'm not putting this on heroines, I guess, but I would not feel comfortable being in a relationship if I did not know that I wasn't already married.
Well, right.
You know what I mean? So in that context, it makes sense that he would be in love first because I'd be too busy thinking, who am I and am I married? So, yeah.
Well, yes. I just thought that normally, you know, in a lot of these older books, as we've discovered, we don't get anything of the hero's thinking at all. And then in the end, when he has given no indication, it's like, of course, you little idiot. Of course I'm in love with you. And we're like, what? So that was kind of why I was so impressed by that artistic choice.
Can't you tell that I love you? Because I've been rude to you and shook you.
Right. And called you an idiot like 6 times.
Yes, exactly. My lip is always curling in disdain. How could you not know that I love you?
Yeah. So we get Sarah, who is the rival, who is the one who finds the ring and deals with that. Okay. And she is, it's one of those, like, I just assumed we would always get married, you know, one of those. Yeah. Well, sucks to be her, because they don't. And, you know, she is clearly the rival. Obviously, we know that she has to be.
Right.
He comes and meets her, and there's like, he goes to help her, and there's like very clearly like some degree of meet cutening happening. You know, they decide that she has this handkerchief with the name Anna embroidered on it, and she has this ring, and Rival put the ring back on her, which was great because, you know, that was important. She sort of, they said, they're like, well, we're going to keep you here. We're going on the police if there's any missing persons report, but like, we're not going to turn you away. You could stay here. And he's like, and there's a Dr. Tranby is there with Noel, and Ruth is sort of her confidant, the person that she really confides in through her time.
Oh, the heroine? What are they calling her?
They call her Anna because of the thing in her pocket, because of the handkerchief. But
oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. It could be anything, but they stick with Anna. So at this moment, she's Anna. She starts doing work in the doctor's office because, of course, she does, you know. And Sarah gets really jealous and is just being really shitty to her. And she says things like, you know, he doesn't sleep and it's all your fault. He's taking up too much of his time with your case. You know, you should just go. So there is one night where, you know, Anna sort of decides that, you know, she's going to figure it out on her own. She feels really guilty about taking up too much of the good doctor's time. And she goes. So also another thing I like about this book that I didn't think I was going to like, but I really did, was that the rival bullshit is not tolerant. Sarah's bullshit.
Oh, good.
He does not put up with it.
Most books, like, they do. In a
very real way. You know, he comes and gets her when she tries to go off.
Where is he trying to go?
She's just trying to go back to where the accident supposedly happened in hopes that she can find some understanding of what happened to her. He obviously comes and finds her and is like clearly very worried about her. And this is where you start seeing the fact that you see in his point of view that he's really worried about her because he cares about her and he doesn't want her to go away.
Right.
She's there and they're sort of slowly getting closer, and they decide that they're all going to go to the sea to swim. And she
began gets,
Anna, Noel, Sarah, Ruth, they all go to the sea to swim.
Okay.
For like a vacation, like a day trip.
Where do they live? Wales?
Wales, yeah.
Okay.
So they get into the water and she totally has like a panic attack. Anna has a panic attack in the water. And clearly we find out, like, well, obviously whatever had happened to her
had something to do with the water.
Had something to do with the water. So, okay, great. Awesome. Love that. Noel rescues her and Sarah is really cruel and is jealous and says, look at you, you idiot. You almost got him killed. Do you have any idea what a loss that would have been?
Why are these people friends with her?
Well, she's like the head nurse, and it says, this is another thing that I thought was really primo. It says the book, when it's in Sarah's point of view, talks about how she had gotten herself wormed her way in to become friends with Ruth, Noel's sister, in order to get closer to him.
Well, that's like high school.
Yeah. The fact that a lot of times these rivals are written to make like the author and therefore the heroine think that they're a legitimate threat to the romance.
Yeah.
And I liked how this one was like, no, it's not that they used to date or that he has, you know, a will they, won't they situation. It's literally just that, like, she's not a very nice person and she has wormed her way in to get close to this guy. And I appreciated that while the character fell into the all other women are garbage trope, I liked the fact that they gave this character a little bit of agency.
Why they feel compelled to include her at all, though, is the question.
I think it's because she's friends with the hero's sister.
No, not why they thought to include her in the trip. Why did the author include her in the book?
Well, we're going to get there.
Okay.
So
I was like, they just feel like throwing in, there has to be another girl in every single book.
Right. Well, yes. And we get both. We get like the kindly friend character who is close to the hero, and we also get the all other women are garbage character. So we get both.
We got this weird manufactured external conflict in every single book.
Yes.
It doesn't even need to be there in most cases.
Yes.
It's just a very strange trope that's going on at that time, that there has to be this, you know, external conflict of another woman in every single book.
Because you know how, you know, women will always just compete with one another. So it's very clear that they're in the ocean, that he's very protective of her and careful with her, and he just doesn't look at Sarah the same way. And you actually get moments in Sarah's point of view where she realizes it. Again, I thought that it was a very interesting, the characters in this book in Strange Recompense don't treat it like a competition. Like the heroine is basically like, I don't even know who I am. I feel this attraction to this guy. I don't really know what's going on. Like, I don't know what your problem is. While Sarah definitely gets under Anna's skin, there are also times where Anna stands up to her and is like, that's not really fair or true, or that's ridiculous. And I appreciate that this heroine has a little bit of like, she has some backbone.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. It's pretty great. I really appreciate it. And I just was really impressed by it. So Sarah starts feeling the pressure of the fact that Dr. Sexy doesn't, you know, seems to have eyes for somebody else. So she kind of goes.
I love Dr. Sexy. That is so funny.
On like a little fact-finding mission. And they are figuring out that there are some missing people who match her description. And that one of them might be in, she has like a Scottish, she has kind of a northern accent. So they look there, and Sarah travels to this town that they have some, they think that maybe Anna has come from. And she basically lies and weasels her way in to talk, figuring out Anna's father and where he lives. And where he goes, excuse me, the pub he goes to at night. And then she's kind of sidles up, talks to him, and gets him to inadvertently spill some beans because he's had a pint or two too many. In like a very, that sort of jovial, good-natured way. Not in a scary way, but yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you say he was Anna's father?
So she goes up to this town in Scotland. And of course, because it's a small town and the other people only exist to further the plot,
She
asks some people and they tell her about the missing girl and how the father goes to the pub.
Okay.
And so Sarah gets the story, talks to her, supposedly Anna's father.
Okay.
And they get this idea, going back to the wedding ring, that Anna had run away with her sister's man. Or Sarah, rather, then goes and finds the sister, Jessica. So we have Anna and Jessica, who are sisters. And she basically, because also through the book, everyone is very religious. So the idea of marriage and marriage vows, it's brought up a couple of times that it's very important to them. And taking their marriage vows seriously is very important to them.
That makes sense for the time period.
Right. So it's the whole idea of like, well, she's already married. You can't have her. So maybe, you know, he'll magically fall in love with someone that he has yet to fall in love with after all these years.
But well, sure, Jan. Could just take her there and see if she's the person they think she is.
Well, they don't bring her because they're kind of like, well, we don't know if these are like actually your people. And I also think that Sarah kind of does some of this on the down low. She doesn't tell people that she's going on this fact-finding mission. So right. They get some information. The doctor finds out her father's name. They write a letter. The father has had a stroke. And the sister answers the letter and says, we don't want anything to do with Anna. She, you know, ran off and we don't want anything to do with her. Right. Basically piss off. And so the doctor then goes up and because he's realizing that Sarah is incredibly cruel and kind of a horrible person. And like, there's a dinner where they're all sitting at dinner before, you know, we get toward the end of the book. And Anna is just like, I'm not hungry. I'm really tired. I just want to go to bed. She gets up and leaves and he storms after her. And you think it's going to be that scene where basically the hero gaslights the heroine into my mother is nice, actually. But he actually whirls around and says to Sarah, you're being an asshole, which I also appreciate because very often that shitty behavior that is done to gain the hero's attention it's not called out for what it is.
Right.
In some ways, it's almost like, I don't know how to say it. In some ways, it's almost like supported. You know what I mean? Noel goes and is like, okay, he goes up to see her sister and her father. And he says that he's the doctor who's going to help the father. But he basically goes in and asks the sister all about it. And apparently the night before, the sister, Anna, had booked a vacation for herself in Wales.
Okay.
And the night before she was supposed to leave, she was really agitated. And after she left, her sister, Jessica, went into her room and found a letter addressed to Anna from Jessica's fiance, Ned.
Okay.
And it was talking about how Ned couldn't go through with the marriage. He didn't want to get married. He thought that he would be fine. And Anna, he was like, I have to see you. And he had to see Anna in order to give her back their grandmother's ring, which had been given to use as a wedding ring when he and Jessica got married.
Okay, so she didn't do anything with the...
No. Obviously, her sister thinks that she did, and that's all that matters, but she didn't. So he finds all of it out, and slowly over time, Anna has been remembering, like, bits and bobs, but that's why she was upset when they went to the beach, and that's why she was walking the cliffside, is because they got into a disagreement. There was a car accident basically on the cliffside and he drove off the cliff and somehow she ended up out of the car. So
Ned is dead.
Ned is dead.
Neddy is deady as we had.
Neddo is deado. Yeah. So we find out that she isn't married. We also find out that she's not a homewrecker. And so Sarah basically has to suck it up and deal. They end up getting married. So they're up in Scotland, like patching things up with her sister, even though, like, you know, it's really hard because the sister's legitimately upset, but they actually have some really good things about grief. And the sister is like Anna says, you know, you can't, he's gone, and you can't spend your entire life, you can't give up your life for what wasn't ever going to be. he wasn't happy. He wouldn't have made a good husband. He didn't want to be married. And
right.
You've got to find a way to move forward. And Jess confesses that she knows that things had changed after he had come home the last time. He hadn't been as excited about getting married. And, you know, he wanted to stay in the Navy. And so
yeah,
they patch things up. And Noel tells her that he's in love with her and that he wants her to come back with him to Wales and live as his wife. And she right. does.
Okay.
And then Ruth, the sister who is lovely through the whole book, she's just delightful, gets married to her long-term suitor, and everyone
has a family. Yeah, because for some reason people can't be single.
No, well, no, they can't. But, like, you know, they still can't now. So, I mean, I can't really be mad at the 40s for that.
True.
But, like, I will say, again, there are a lot of elements of the way this book was written that I was really impressed by. I was impressed by the fact that we got the hero's inner turmoil as he sort of emotionally got to the point where he was acknowledging that he was in love with the heroine. I thought that that was really good.
This sounds like a pretty good book.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Like, for this time period, would I pick it up now? Probably not.
No, because these books are torture, these early books.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I mean, granted, I'm sure the bar is relatively low with a lot of this earlier stuff. Like, it's culturally not anything
for real
that we have any connection to. It's not anything that I don't feel like I don't have that sort of shared history.
Yeah. But
there were a lot of parts of this that I really appreciated. Like, I thought that the characters were people. And even the rival is given character development where she talks about how, you know, she had worked her way up to be a respected nurse and she would be a good partner. She and Noel have a common interest in medicine and healthcare. And she always just sort of figured that eventually he would look at her in that way. And, you know, a lot of times it's really hard to, you're not intended to feel empathy for the rival character, but in this instance, you do. And I think that it's warranted and it makes these characters feel like people, you know, and even the sister, Jessica, yeah, she's upset because she wanted to get married. She was in love with this person. And she thinks that not only did she lose her fiance, but she lost her sister. And so she's really hurt. And yeah, like,
totally. That's very justified.
Right. And the book shows that. And it also, it's the girls who are patching it up themselves and supporting each other as sisters. I really liked it. I really liked the fact that she was a person. Anna was a person who her internal thoughts and feelings were not just the hero.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I liked the fact that everyone had reasonable character development. The sister, you know, it was like, we're brother and sister. And like, it's just us. Our parents are gone. And I kind of want to be here to take care of the house, but I also know that eventually at some point I kind of have to have my own life. It was just, it was nice to have.
The standards are definitely low when we're like, hey, people are real characters.
But I would also argue, and I say this with love, as we all know that this is a genre we both love dearly. I would argue, and granted, I know we both didn't read this book, but I would pit the characterization in this book. The plot is whatever. It's basic. We could have
seen yeah.
turns coming from a mile away. But in terms of yeah. like the depth of the character development and the amount of being a person that we get, I would pit this against many, 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 many modern category romances.
Hey, that's awesome.
I would pit it, maybe not so much. I do think, as we said in previous episodes, I do think that the fact that things like Kindle Unlimited and Wattpad and all of those things have, I think they've broken the yoke that was held by traditional publishing houses to make things so very streamlined. But I would also say that I think, you know, these are characters whose character development is not tragic backstory. Their character development happens throughout the book.
I mean, I love a tragic backstory, but it's nice to watch people go through an arc during a story.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing. Like, these characters actually develop over time, and I appreciate it. But we do have, you know, for our tropes, we definitely have, this is an amnesia book. So this is definitely
this is the first amnesia book.
It is. And I'm so excited because we're probably going to read 1,000,000,005 more of them.
Oh, sure.
A lot of those books, I think that we mistook like events and talking about events for having a character. You know, like I do think like a lot of those rom susses, and I, you know, nothing against the genre. I'm you know,
it's my favorite.
Not for me, but there are a lot of subgenres in romance that are not for me. Yep. But I think that in a lot of the suspense ones, character is particularly thin.
Yeah, yeah. It's really hard because they're like 65,000 words, which is not a lot. That's practically a novella. And you still have to have a certain amount of plot.
And then you have to devote 15% of it to sex.
I honestly don't know how they do it. Julie Miller, she's not an old writer. She's, you know, early 2000s. I don't know if she's still writing, but she does an exceptionally good job at it. But most people don't. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to read the Harlequin romantic suspenses, I'd look for Julie Miller. She's very good. But otherwise, yeah, I don't know how they do it.
I feel like it often is a subcategory to me. And I say this as someone who just like, it's fine. If you love romantic suspense, I love it. I love the fact that it exists for someone to love it. That person is not me.
It's me.
I feel like with a lot of it, it reminds me of my middle schoolers when they write creatively. It's like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then it's worse.
And then
I've read
worse.
One once. Where we got all the way up to a human trafficking ring, and I was like, why is this happening? like, so yeah, you know, I think we had some good, some surprises this time, which is great.
Yeah.
Because I believe last time, Amber, neither of us were happy.
No, no.
At least I know I really wasn't.
Yeah, that was an awful,
I remember being very upset.
War book, yeah. I was upset just hearing about it. So,
you know, Amber, what is your happily for now?
I'm just going to have to go with snow, which I know people in the more snowy parts of the world will be harassed by. But for us, it's a delight. So
you know what? I think it's great. I think it's wonderful if people can enjoy it, enjoy it. I struggle, but it has always been a part of my life. So there we are.
Yep. By noon tomorrow, it'll all be melted and we won't see snow again for a year. But, you know,
yeah.
I'm enjoying it right now.
Yeah.
And you?
So I think mine is we are heading out where the days are getting longer. And, you know, I'm not a lover of winter. And I think that my happily right now is I'm looking forward to a spring. Yeah.
We just had literal polar opposite happily for now.
I know. Mine is more, it's not so much snow, it's more the daylight.
Yeah,
that gets me. The lack of daylight really kind of bums me out. So
it's funny that we both have sad but like at different times.
I know. Well, my another one of my friends too struggles in the summertime.
Oh, it's so awful. The sun is just so relentless. I want to die.
This was fun.
I think this is literally the first time that we've ever both liked our books.
I am surprised at how much I enjoyed this book. I think that there is some real positive writing demonstrated, and I am glad that I read it.
Yeah, mine's just sad, but it's incredibly well written. So
yes. Well, you know, thank you, friends, for joining us in another episode of Categorically Insane. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you next time for more of a trip back in time to the vault of Harlequin romance.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Categorically Insane.
If you'd like to find us or see the covers of the books that we're reading, we are at categoricallyinsane@gmail.com, categoricallyp as in pod on Twitter, at Categorically Insane One Word on Instagram, and at Categorically Insane Two Words on Facebook. Please follow us, review us, and share us to help us get off the ground as a brand new podcast. Thanks.